proceed to the fifth case of the United States v. Carter. Mr. McFadden.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Christopher McFadden on behalf of the United States. In this bank robbery case, the district court found that law enforcement violated the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights through an illegal search and seizure. The government argued that there were three pieces of evidence discovered through the investigation of the bank robbery that were attenuated from that illegal search due to intervening circumstances. However, the district court suppressed all three pieces of evidence and relied impermissibly on but-for reasoning in order to do so. This court reviews the application of the exclusionary rule de novo, and we ask that the order of the district court suppressing evidence be reversed. As I said, there were three pieces of evidence. The first piece of evidence was the identification by the bank teller of the defendant as the bank robber. The bank teller was shown photographs of six people. One of the photographs was a picture of the defendant. The picture of the defendant was taken from a Chicago Police Department database. It was not the photograph that was on the ID card taken from the defendant's apartment.
But I think the district court's concern was how did they get to that picture? Because there's this ambiguous word that's used. I guess your theory is that Mr. Alvarado and some other people were saying that this was Carter's unit, and so even without finding the ID card inside the unit, you could show that. But I guess you have the conversation with Burke, who is really the one who's talking to Alvarado, and the interview just says Alvarado confirmed that Carter was living in the apartment. I can't tell from that whether Burke said who lives there and Alvarado said it's Carter, or whether Burke said we think Carter lives there, can you confirm that? And Alvarado says yes, or how does that happen?
I agree, and the best I can explain it is this. Burke did write the report. He used the word confirmed, and the district court seized on that, and she drew the inference, well, Burke or somebody must have mentioned the name David Carter to Alvarado.
Relying on that ID that was found in there.
Correct. But that part, that issue was resolved just on the pleadings by the district court in our papers. She didn't grant, the hearing was limited to the attenuation doctrine, and it wasn't really so much, it didn't focus on that at the hearing. And I think one reason that we didn't really focus on that, I don't know honestly if it matters, Judge, whether the name David Carter was mentioned to Alvarado or not. And here's why. I think in any attenuation case, there's some type of reliance on the illegally obtained evidence. The question is just then, for policy reasons or for reasons of attenuation, are we still going to suppress? And in this case, well, all that we have is, at most, the mentioning by Burke of identity-related evidence to Alvarado in order to then gather other identity-related evidence. Simply knowing the name of David Carter said nothing about whether or not David Carter was the bank robber. And we've cited several lines of cases that says that if the illegally obtained evidence just leads you to a database, then anything in that database can be used for whatever is relevant. And then we also cited cases that said that if all you get is identity-related evidence, the subsequent investigation, what you learn through that investigation, should not be suppressed because that essentially gives the defendant lifelong immunity from investigation or prosecution.
I wanted to go back to the basic criteria for an attenuation analysis, because in your case, the time factor isn't very helpful to you. This is not something that happened a few days later or whatever. It's a pretty tight timeline, so that's not helpful. It seems to me you're relying on the presence of intervening circumstances, but I don't know what intervenes.
I agree. First, as to the timing factor, and let me tie this into intervening circumstances, I'm not aware of a single case, and the defendant didn't cite one, where the timing factor tipped the scale in favor of suppressing evidence when that evidence was a confession given by somebody who had no knowledge of the illegality, or when the evidence was evidence obtained through a consensual search, when the person who gave consent to search had no idea about the illegality.
Sure, and those are your other two pieces of evidence. I guess I'm focusing on the bank teller, because when you get to the suppression of the bait bills and you get to the confession, you may be on stronger ground. But the bank teller, I'm concerned about.
As to the bank teller, and I tried to flesh this out in the briefs, even if you say the timing factor tips in favor of the defendant, which is what the district court said, we cited to this court the Cecchellini case and also the Seventh Circuit's decision in Carcello. And both of those cases said if an illegality leads to a witness and the witness either testifies at a hearing or gives evidence or gives a statement that leads to evidence that's subsequently discovered. What we should really be looking at is, did the illegal search somehow coerce that witness into providing that information? Because as the Supreme Court said, witness testimony, a lot of times witnesses are not influenced. There could be a Fourth Amendment violation, but that plays no meaningful role as to whether a witness wants to talk to law enforcement. And
so
really,
you want us to apply that to Mr. Alvarado?
I do. And I think that the district court cited the Cacciolini case, and then in our reply brief, because the defendant had said in his response brief, he said, hey, Cacciolini doesn't apply, we then cited the Carcello case. And this court said in Carcello, yeah, Cacciolini applies not only to statements by somebody who wants to apply it to testify at trial, but it also applies to evidence derived from statements by a witness who voluntarily came forward and provided that information. There was really no coercion involved here. I don't think there's any dispute there. The only connection between Alvarado talking to police and the illegal search is the fact that Alvarado heard the police upstairs making noise.
Well, Alvarado heard the police, and it's possible, at least, that they fed him the name.
Correct. And that goes back to my earlier point about the use of identity-related evidence not being, if all you have is the use of identity-related evidence, then that's not enough to justify suppressing everything else down the line. Just moving on to the second and third issues about the consent search and then also the confession, I think this court's decision in United States versus Liss is right on point. It says that if there is a voluntary consent to search somewhere, particularly by somebody who did not know about the illegal search at location one, then evidence found in the search of location two should not be suppressed because in this case it makes perfect sense. The officers who went to that apartment did not know about the illegal search. The person who gave consent did not know about the illegal search. So there's really nothing more than but-for causation. Were the officers perhaps motivated to go to the second apartment by what they learned at the first apartment? Yes. But that was also addressed in the List case, and this court said we're not going to probe the officers' motivations because officers can go and they can seek consent from anybody for whatever reason, and then that second person can either say yes or no. I'd also like to spend a minute on the flagrancy and purpose factor because that's one of three factors here, and the district court found that that weighed against the United States. However, there are a couple reasons that I don't think much weight, respectfully, should be given to the court's analysis in this case. First of all, this court applies de novo review, so it's a de novo standard of review as to how far out you're going to take the exclusionary rule. But second, the court relied on a couple facts, only a couple facts, and one of them, I think we all agree, was a mistaken view of the record. The district court found flagrancy because the district court was of the mistaken view that the police officer knew that David Carter was receiving electrical bills at that address. And certainly if somebody is receiving electrical bills, that is a pretty good indicia of ownership and occupancy. But as we pointed out, that was incorrect. Nobody knew about the electrical bills until the FBI agent went back there in June and then wrote an FBI 302 in June. So one of the district court's facts was incorrect. And as to the remaining facts, as you had said earlier, I believe, Judge Wood, it's our position this was an ambiguous situation at best. You have a police officer who's there, and he says, is anybody up there? And the landlord's relative says, Carter's girlfriend stays up there sometimes. They both moved out. Sometimes they come back, but nobody's up there right now, and the owner is in the process of kicking them out. And then there were fresh footprints in the snow. Well, that back door leads to two apartments. It leads to Alvarado's apartment, and it leads to the first floor apartment. So the footprints in the snow, I don't think you can put too much weight on that. And then as to what the landlord's relative said, respectfully, I submit that's ambiguous at best. And the district court heard the officer testify. He did testify at the hearing. The most that the district court said is that these violations should have been obvious, that the officer acted objectively unreasonably. The district court had a chance to see this officer make demeanor and credibility findings, and she never found that he acted recklessly, that he willfully violated the law. At most, what we have here is a mistake by an officer. And the Supreme Court has said in many cases, I think most recently in the Herring decision, we don't suppress evidence based on mistakes. We suppress evidence when there is a willful violation of the law. And for those reasons, I do think that it would be improper to suppress the three pieces of evidence in this case. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. McFadden. Mr. Madden.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Matthew Madden with the Federal Defender. I represent David Carter. The key question to any analysis under attenuation, I think, is whether the evidence came from an exploitation of the illegality or not. That burden is, of proof is on the government, and they have not carried that burden, and they cannot carry that burden in this case because the evidence, the information gotten in the illegal search was exploited at every step of the investigation.
But I don't see how it's exploited. Excuse me. How it's exploited with respect to the bait bills and the confession. I mean, I can see where the teller identification is a little closer to the illegality, but we really do. I mean, attenuation doesn't mean that you've completely broken. It's not the same thing as independent source, right?
Correct.
Independent source would be no relation whatever, but attenuation is attenuation. And so they go over, they get consent, nobody knows what's going on.
Well, Judge,
I mean, only in the most remote, you know, house that Jack built sort of sense is that ID card operating by that time.
Judge, I think that there is no attenuation, you know, and the government wants to focus on whether he's got a privacy interest in the May Street apartment and whether he's whether the consent was voluntary. I don't think those are really the biggest issues in this kind of analysis. I think the discovery of the bait bills is tainted, and the reason being, they're there. The Burke's investigation was completely influenced by the ID card, and they are there to find the bait bills because of the ID card. So, and I'll explain to you what I mean, Judge. What we know from the stipulation at the hearing is that the officers who discovered Carter at the apartment were driving around the neighborhood armed with a picture of David Carter, asking street sources, do you know, have you seen David Carter? They were not driving.
Why doesn't Liss dispose of this case the other way? I mean, Liss doesn't require there to be no link whatsoever. I take your point. I'm sure they were looking for David Carter by that time. They'd had Alvarado name him. They'd found the ID card. They'd run other things. But the people who were doing the driving around hadn't seen the ID card, I don't think.
That's correct, Judge. And I think the key difference here between this and Liss, the officers were at the property before the illegality ever took place. And that does make it different because these officers never would have gotten to the property without the illegality. And I certainly understand the point
but
that they did.
It sounds like you're trying to argue for independent source then.
Oh, well, Judge, I'm not putting forth
I don't think the government could meet that burden. If that's what they had to meet, they can't. But attenuation is the burden they need to meet.
Well, Judge, you're right. The officers were not given the card. They never saw the card. That's not the important part, I don't think. I think the important part is that the information from the card was passed along to them, and they utilized that information and relied on that information.
So the name Carter could never be sought, or that particular person could not be sought from that point forward? Is that what you're saying?
No, Judge. I think that person certainly could be sought if they came up with a way that attenuated it. At that point, it had not been attenuated yet. The reason they knew David Carter was simply because, and this will go back to Alvarado, I think, but the reason they knew to look for David Carter and just David Carter, a very specific search, was because of what they found on the ID card.
But isn't it really they find the ID card and then Alvarado says what he says, perhaps in part because of the ID card, I don't know. I mean, at least maybe they're asking Alvarado about somebody named Carter because of the ID card. But we've got a few steps in the chain before we get to the people in the car looking around for the May Street place.
That's certainly true. There are several steps in the chain. I don't think at any point it attenuates, though. And as to Alvarado, I think the key analysis with him is that Burke did not, he ignored the other eight names. He was given nine names. He ignored eight of them. He was able to ignore those eight names because he had the card. He had the name David Carter. So I think the key is that the card is what influenced Burke's investigation, not any information provided by Alvarado.
Didn't it just narrow his search? He could have searched all the names. He could have gotten photos, perhaps, of several of them that he had.
That's true, Judge. I think that does wade a little bit into inevitable discovery, which I think the government seems to have abandoned at this point. And certainly we could speculate about what could have been done and what they may have done, but The bottom line, even if they did this, Judge, even if they went, looked at nine names, And they pulled up a clear search for all nine names, and there was a picture for all nine names. The timing here is far, far different. There's no doubt about that.
Don't you think, I mean, this does take us back to inevitable discovery, but don't you think if they'd looked at all nine names, given the fact that they had a description of this person from the bank and from the food court, that they would have been right back at Carter?
Well, Judge, if they looked at the nine names
without the ID card, they get nine names. They have already, certainly you would agree, with no taint. They have the description from the bank and the description from the food court. Why wouldn't they match right up again with Carter?
Well, this does go back. Once the pictures are in front of them, I would agree with you, Judge. I don't think the pictures will ever get in front of them. Without the illegal search, Tom goes to the address. Tom talks to a woman who knows nothing about, doesn't give him David Carter's name, and does not say anything about a bank robbery. If he doesn't go to the step doing the search, where is he? I mean, he likely leaves at that point. I think it would be unbelievable that the FBI would show up and start investigating this address based on nothing more than a month ago there was a man, a white man in his 40s or 50s, who may or may not be bald. The FBI just never gets involved at that point. So I guess the pictures never show up, Judge. I think if you were able to skip that, then fine, I would agree with you. So before I run out of time, I do want to talk about... Can I just go back for a second? The Cecchellini, Carcello argument, I never have, frankly, understood, and I don't now, but Cecchellini and the Carcello, I just don't think are in any way relevant here. I think Alvarado was not a witness to anything. Bring Alvarado in, he would have nothing to testify in front of a jury to a bank robbery about. That is really what Cecchellini and Carcello were about. He had no information of a crime, and we haven't challenged anything Frank Alvarado said. As to the purposefulness and flagrancy of this, the district court, I would agree with the government. The district court was able to observe Officer Tome, and it was able to listen firsthand to his testimony concerning the events leading up to the search. And the court, in viewing him, I think was correct in stating the factual conclusion that Officer Tome could not have reasonably believed the apartment was abandoned. The only person he spoke to was the girlfriend of the landlord's son, someone who no reasonable officer would ever think could give consent to enter the apartment. She also informed him, I think this is the exact same language the government uses, is we're in the process of kicking him out. That means that they're still in the apartment. There also were fresh footprints outside. I think Tom here was engaging in exactly the type of improper fishing expedition that this court warned against in Reed. He was hoping to come up with something that would lead somewhere.
The government's not challenging the suppression of the ID card itself and the original search. So we're beyond that. We're just trying to figure out if it's created enough of a taint on other things.
That's correct, Judge. And I was addressing that because Herring does say that is an important analysis and what gets excluded and what does not get excluded. I think it is clear here that it was flagrant. And I do think that the intervening search, I'm back to what I was talking about before, Judge, but I think it is what this court is interested in, is that there has to be an attenuation before they get to that apartment. The very fact that they're knocking on the door of that apartment is a problem, and that is tainted because there has been no break before that. So the consent doesn't break it. The fact that they got there to begin with is tainted. And I think the district court pointed out there was a direct nexus between the illegal search and the subsequent arrest. And I think that does taint not only the bait bills, but also taints the statement. I think that is the key to the second half of this, I guess. And the record is not as filled in as it might be on the second half of this. Unless the government can show that it was broken before they got to that apartment, I think that there is no attenuation here.
Mr. Madden, is it your position that Mr. Tomey would never go to that apartment off of the original facts of this case?
Could never have gone in that apartment?
Not physically, but I mean, there's no reason to go to the apartment off his hunch?
Oh, no, Judge, I've always found it kind of strange that he went to the apartment, but I think he certainly was entitled to go to the apartment.
He's there, right?
Correct.
Now I understand the photo, I think. So The meeting with Mr. Alvarado, where we get the list, that isn't separate and apart from the search?
Well, I think this is important. I'm glad you asked that, Judge. Tome never meets with Alvarado. He says very clearly at the hearing, I talked to one woman, that's it. So Burke meets with Alvarado.
I mean Burke, excuse me.
Burke meets with Alvarado, but that is, like I said, Alvarado in no way influenced Burke's investigation. If it would have influenced his investigation, then I think we might have a different discussion here. But Burke ignored the other eight names, and it did not influence him in one bit. And Burke, frankly, never would have been there without the ID card.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Brown. Mr. McFadden, I think you have about a minute.
Judge, I just want to make two points really quickly. By the time we get to that second apartment, the only connection between the illegal search at the first apartment and them being at the second apartment is but-for causation. I mean, and List did squarely deal with that. If the motive to search location two is supplied from an illegal search of location one, that doesn't matter because the voluntary consent to search breaks the chain, the causal chain between the two places. And I also just want to point out that card, it gave them a lead only in the sense it gave them the name of a possible suspect. They had already known the person's age, height, weight, race. They knew he was a local person, and they knew what he was wearing out there on this cold day in February. So the investigation was already ongoing. It just focused them on this person, and then from there they had to do the rest of the investigation. And I think cases have repeatedly said that simply learning somebody's identity is not enough. So we ask that the order of the district court be reversed. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McFadden. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And